This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. We're at 101.3 KPCG, Edmond, Oklahoma City area. Enjoying a little bit of a rainy Wednesday. And online, thanks for joining us at kpcg.fm. Different weather patterns in different parts of the world. Different times of the day. Different seasons of the year. And yet we're all here. That's like it's a poem, right?
That was brilliant.
Yeah, wow. Just came to me.
You should get paid for that.
Dwight Sonnet number one.
Number one. That's number one of many. But we appreciate you guys listening all around the world at kpcg.fm. Also, a live link there at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. And also email us comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And be glad you guys don't work for ESPN.
I already am.
You'd be getting fired. ESPN's going to cut more than 100 employees. They said they were going to cut about 40 to 50. They've upped it to 100. According to Yahoo Finance, and that number, of course, is bigger than the 40 to 50 they reported earlier. And a lot of them, they say the 100 people getting cut are all on-air talent. So they're going to cut away some of those personalities. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. They say they have about 1,000 people they consider on-air talent, so they're getting rid of 10% of them. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if there's any big names. Probably not, but who knows?
Yeah, and it also, that kind of just reminds us how the production team is really the important part of a lot of those shows. Obviously, it's great to have strong personalities as well, but if it's not presented in a way that is pleasant for people to look at or to listen to, then it just really isn't as good. There are a lot of people who can speak words in a certain way. That's why presenters are getting cut a little bit more.
Well, some of the presenters, now in some cases, they're former athletes, so it sort of makes sense.
They're already made. They're set for life.
Yeah, but sometimes they can't barely get two words out.
Right.
They can't understand what they're saying. But also, a lot of it's just opinion. Now, you know, if it's somebody that's, say, a reporter or they have some experience with teams or they have some inside information, there's something interesting about that. But after that, it's mostly just opinion. And that's a lot of news today, whether it be sports or you know, political commentary or anything. It's just sort of a general opinion without any sort of research and you know, being an insider. So you do have to wonder at some point, well, what's the value of that? Because we all have opinions.
Yeah, well, even last time I watched ESPN, and they cycled through some of the shows, and I think it was at the DMV, actually. I was waiting in their room, like in the waiting room, for about 10 hours, and they had ESPN on. And I was like, who are these guys? Like, I recognize a couple of them from other things, but other one, I had no idea. I've never heard of them, never read their articles or heard their podcasts or whatever else they're famous for. And that's not saying much, being a Canadian. But still, why should I listen to you if you're just ranting about something where the next newspaper guy will have a different opinion that you can read for free online at your own pleasure?
Yeah.
Like, so it's, I wonder if they're, like you mentioned yesterday, consolidate and just air more of the big names on like their big shows, or I have no idea.
It's all about making money, and if you can't make money on those shows, then you got to get rid of people. So that's what's going to happen. And then a lot of guys have jumped ship, though. They've left ESPN. They went to Fox Sports One, and interesting time for broadcasters, that's for sure. This is a really interesting write-up that was sent in from a listener. We appreciate those. You can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. And it's an article from Heat Street, The Millennial Death Spiral. And they're focusing on that generation in particular, which you guys are. I'm a little outside of that, but you could kind of lump yourself into it, I guess. Basically, if you are using screens a lot, which we all do. And they're just talking about some reports about how, you know, people are using so much, they're using their screens so much, their smartphones, and it is affecting them in different ways. And it's one of those situations where we don't have a long enough history to know exactly what it does, but they're starting to see a few things. Just a couple of excerpts from this. They say, we can't be certain exactly how long millennials, also known as Generation Y, and again, that you could lump probably quite a few people even outside of the generation into that. We can't tell how much time they spend looking at screens, But anyone who has recently spent any time in a city can affirm young people are hugely dependent on their cell phones and look and feel anxious without them. In 2015, the Pew Research Center found that nearly half of all millennials felt they, quote, couldn't live without their smartphone. That might be an exaggeration, but they probably do feel that way. Shockingly, they say, a more recent report conducted by Bank of America. Why is Bank of America doing reports? Anyway, they did a report. Found that 39% of millennials claim to interact more with their smartphones than they do with actual humans. They probably were doing it because they wanted to see the best way to reach them with their banking services.
Right.
So they interact with their phones more than humans, 39% anyway. In 2014, it was estimated that millennials spend over 2 hours per day on the devices, which that can only have subsequently increased. I would think that has increased a lot. 2 hours seems low to me.
Well, even if it's not on a smartphone, it's on another screen, TV, computer, tablet, whatever it might be.
They say millennials are suffering phobias, post-traumatic stress disorders, and social anxiety at twice the rate of their baby boomer parents. Web Psychology recently found that 1 in 5 millennials has called into work sick due to depression and anxiety. I can't make it today. I'm sad, guys.
Just going to let everyone else down.
Yeah.
Can't come in today.
They say it should be noted, though, that while more young people are prescribed drugs such as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and beta blockers, advances in medicine mean that doctors have become more aware than ever about how to diagnose mental illness. So they're giving them this medication. They think that's going to help. They say, though, here's a better idea. Get a prescription to the drug called Life. They say to do this, we need to make a concerted effort to put down our cell phones, not like forever, they say, but for a short while each day and look up at the world around us, interact with other human beings, have some opinions, debate a few things, read more books, and realize that life isn't really that bad after all. In fact, when it's good, it's the very best. So they have a little bit of a humorous, snarky take on it. But the points are good, I think. That what's happening to any of us if we just are caught up in these screens and we're not interacting with other human beings?
You mentioned millennials feeling panicked when they are away from those screens for a little bit. I saw a 30-year-old, which I believe that does fall within the millennial time frame, talking about how he would actually choose his phone over eating and drinking for 24 hours. So he would rather fast or just basically begin the process of starvation. Obviously, it's the early stages, though, instead of giving up his phone. Or he even said he would take his phone over his wife. This is the part where I think he was exaggerating, but it really does get pretty extreme a lot of the time. And he even said he'd kick his wife out of a helicopter to keep his phone. So I think at that point he was really getting a bit crazy. But there was also a study on there that said that over 30% of couples have at least one of the two depressed because the other one is spending too much time on a screen. So it really is even a cause of division in relationships.
It's very easy for it to take up a major part of your life, screen time. And sometimes you do have to recognize that and say, that's it, no more phones today.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to just kind of, and like it's pointed out in this article, even the writer, he's a millennial himself. He's in the mix. And he says, you know, he finds himself taking unnecessary quote-unquote breaks during the day. I got to check my Facebook. I've got to check Instagram. I've got to check Twitter. And there's really no reason. There's nothing there that he's really doing. There's no benefit. It's just a crutch that he feels like he needs to have. And those things start to creep up. And then, you know, what becomes of somebody like that? What happens to them 5 years down the road? Apparently phobias, anxieties, and who knows what else.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was, when I first got a smartphone or something I could check my emails up other than a huge home computer where everyone was sharing. if I left it at home or forgot it somewhere, and 2 days later I had to get it, I'm like, oh no, like someone must have tried to contact me. I look and got zero emails, zero notifications. So no one was trying to get a hold of me. And that's usually what I find. There's nothing on there for me to look at 90% of the time. And so I think it's people, I think what those sort of things, it inflates your sense of who you are or like what you can be and that kind of thing in a way if you're not careful. But also it's a portal into escapism, into like a separate world that isn't really real and doesn't affect your how much money you're making, the people around you that are the most important, that affect your life the most. And I know in some places, I think this is mainly happening in Japan, but people get so much into their alternate universes on their phones from like games or TV shows or just whatever it is. They marry like cartoon characters and video game characters and movie characters. And that's an extreme case, but that's basically where people's minds are going the longer we stay connected with those instead of the real world.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting if you spend some time occasionally talking to somebody that's older, you know, in their 60s, 70s, maybe beyond that. And if you ask them a little bit about their lives, it's pretty remarkable, like the things people have done. You know, they fought in a war. They had this career, then they did this other thing. Like some pretty remarkable things. And just, you know, they would be considered average people. But they did a lot. They know a lot. Things that are important, how to do certain things. But I think it just goes to show what you can accomplish when you actually do something in life as opposed to just being caught up in this fantasy world. And I thought about that because, Abraham, you said, you know, people, like, and it's pointed out in this article, too, they're trying to make this life on social media that's probably better than their real life is. And they're spending so much time doing that that they're not actually living. But people from years ago, when they didn't have all those distractions, in most cases did something. And it's pretty remarkable what they did at the end of the day when you look at it. Think, wow, you guys did all that. But they were actually doing something, not pretending to do something, if you can say it that way.
How would the average person today stack up with people back then? Like you were saying, those people back then, they fought in wars, and that was just a normal person. Obviously, we're not involved in as many huge wars now, but still, I mean, there are other ways to contribute than by going to war, and a lot of people... it is easy to just spectate. We can watch all the things on a screen instead of actually having to go and do them. So that actually does make a pretty big difference.
It's going to be fascinating to see. This is always the way it goes with any type of new technology or anything that's introduced into the human life, human lives, whether it be technology or food or whatever. What happens 20 years later? We find this out all the time with dietary things. Oh, shouldn't have been eating that. And like we're going to talk about later, then they tell you you shouldn't eat something. It turns out, actually, you should. And, you know, but it takes time. And by the time you find out, sometimes it's too late. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we all have those phones and we all have to deal with them. But you always think about the kids, too. If you're growing up and that, you just, that's from day one. I saw that the other day. I saw a little toddler sitting in a cart playing a video game. You know, and they were consumed by it, so they weren't crying or making a deal. But and I'm not saying that's, you know, worst thing ever. I'm just saying if that's what you know from the cradle, what does that make you at the end of the day?
Yeah, well, I think this is my personal opinion. No child should have a device unless they can pay for it themselves, especially something like a smartphone. You get a job and you want to buy one, go ahead and do it if you want. You've earned the responsibility and that. In some circumstances, that's just my, because that's what my dad did for me. If I wanted a cell phone, I had to go buy it myself. I wasn't given one. And I didn't have any friends to call anyway, so it didn't matter. But another phenomenon I've been noticing, just especially on YouTube and people who stream, like the live streaming stuff, it's almost as if we're in this new age where people watch other people's lives instead of living their own. They're content to sit at home and watch other people travel, other people do things, eat, cook, anything you can imagine. They'd rather watch other people do it than do it themselves. And that's just a weird thing to think about, that when you look back on what you've done the last 5 years, like, well, I've watched a thousand different people do amazing things, but I haven't really done anything myself. It's just kind of an odd phenomenon.
Yeah, right. That's exactly you know what we're talking about. If you look back at those older generations, they were doing things and they developed skills and abilities, and it's different times now. So I think it's just different. So anyway, really interesting write-ups from Heat Street, the Millennial Death Spiral. There's a lot more in that, but those are just some of the highlights, and it's worth thinking about, especially if you yourself have a phone, which we all do, or you have kids. You got to think about what that's doing to them. Some great shows today on KPCG. We always do have good programming, if we do say so ourselves. Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, today. Make sure you listen for that. Also, check out thetrumpet.com, the top story today. Also by Stephen Fleury, Not So Fruited Plains, the choicest land on earth, falls behind Brazil and Russia. So that's a really big deal. As far, we don't think a lot about food because it's always available, but it doesn't mean it always will be. Related to that, the downfall of American agriculture by Brad McDonald, and the United States and Britain in Prophecy. That gives you a great just overview of where we've been, where we're going. And that's by Herbert W. Armstrong. Also, the Trumpet Hour today. Really special Trumpet Hour program. You're used to hearing all the trumpet columnists talk about some of the major events going on. Today, an interview with British journalist Melanie Phillips. So that's a great program. Make sure it's going to be on a couple times today. And you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. And it says this, in advance of a visit, because she's going to be coming here, by the way, to the Trumpet's offices on May the 7th. She'll be at Armstrong Auditorium. It's free. You can come listen to her. She'll be there May 7th. She spoke with Joel Hilliker today about her political journey, how she went from being a darling of the left to being Britain's most controversial champion of national and cultural identity. She also explains how the liberal view in Britain has been transformed into a radical left view, and how her determination to stick to the facts put her at odds with journalistic establishment over issue after issue, including family, education, multiculturalism, Islam, and Israel. Really, really, really great program today. That's the Trumpet Hour program. And then she'll be coming here, too, to Armstrong Auditorium. There'll be more details about that on thetrumpet.com, but she'll be here on May the 7th. If you're in the local area or if you're coming into the local area, you can come by and see her. That's for free. So she has a lot of interesting things to say. She's had a lot of experiences. You can hear it on the Trumpet Hour today.
Yeah, she really is a fantastic writer and speaker, and it's pretty exciting to have her come here. That's a pretty great connection for the work, and she obviously has a lot of perspective from that side of the world, the Middle East, Britain. She really knows a lot about what's going on over there and is rightly disturbed by a lot of the trends that she's seeing. And it's pretty easy to take some of those trends and see them in America as well, which is also pretty concerning to us.
She's very interesting to listen to. Make sure you listen to the Trumpet Hour program today, because she's talking a lot about what we're seeing happen in the media, which is a big, big issue. But she's not giving you this general opinion from afar. I mean, she's lived it. She experienced it. She went through it personally, is a member of the media, and so what she says carries weight.
Yeah, I think it's always fascinating when you get it from their perspective, because you can really see the forces at play, the shape people. And all. I mean, there's thousands of journalists, top journalists in Britain and around the world, millions, but there's very few who people actually listen to with a lot of authority, and she's one of them. I think she has a huge following, and it's great to see how people form their worldview and their political view, because you see what it's based off of, and a lot of it's based off of experiences where they saw failure, or they saw a huge problem, they wanted to fix it, and they realized that they had to change, or that something was terribly wrong and they had to point it out to people in order to force that change. And so it's really fascinating, and especially in the UK where there was a very proud liberal movement. Winston Churchill was a liberal. They did a lot of great things for England. But after it collapsed in the 30s, it got hijacked by what we're seeing in America today, that radical left, the movement towards radical socialism, even more socialist than the socialists themselves. Mm-hmm. That's what liberalism is today, but it wasn't always like that. And it's just really interesting to see how that transformation took place.
She talks about that on the Trumpet Hour today. And, yeah, really great program. Make sure you stop and listen to that if you get a chance to do so. And, again, the archives will be online at kpcg.fm and at the trumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online there at kpcg.fm as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm and email us comments at kpcg.fm. In the news recently, there's been the airline situations where the passengers had some problems with getting taken off of flights, and that's been in the news a little bit. And then there was another instance that happened recently, just over the weekend. I think it was, I want to say, American Airlines. Is that right? So the airlines they're having their issues. So there's some interesting numbers here that maybe are worth looking at. The approximate number of passengers who boarded flights originating in the U.S. in 2016 are 660 million. So that's a fair number. The number of passengers who were bumped voluntarily, 434,425. So it gives you some understanding of how many people get on flights, and then obviously some get bumped. It does happen. The number of passengers who were bumped involuntarily, so you got to go, even though you don't want to, 40,629. And ExpressJet, they were the airline that involuntarily bumped the highest percentage of their passengers in 2016. Sorry, ExpressJet. And Hawaiian Airlines was the airline that involuntarily bumped the lowest percentage of passengers in 2016. So if you're taking Hawaiian Airlines, chances are you'll maybe get on there. get to your flight or get to your destination a little more quickly. But they bring out here, too, in this piece that just the reality of what happens on an airplane, sometimes maybe we don't know this, passengers are legally obligated to obey airline staff once they get on the plane. I mean, I think we all know that. They basically are the captains of the ship. They tell you to do something. It's within a certain bound, I'm sure, area. You have to do that, and if you don't, then you can be removed. So whether you like it or not, that's the law of the plane. And they say many people are under the impression that when they buy an airline ticket, they are purchasing a seat on the plane. That's not necessarily the case. What you're paying for, what we're all paying for, is transportation from point A to point B. And their only obligation in the airline is to get you there as soon as they can.
Yeah, well, it's a good point for all of us to keep in mind. And I think it's good to remember that about twice the population of the United States goes on aircrafts every year. So that's a lot of people. And 40,000 people being bumped involuntarily is a pretty small amount considering the traffic of people going through there. So I think things always go better when we obey the laws, and especially on airplanes. Make it easy on everyone by saying or doing what the staff says and all that. So that's probably a good lesson to take away from all that. I did hear too, on United Airlines, they were transporting a 3-foot rabbit.
Died.
Yeah, he died on the way over from the UK to America.
Yeah, he's a huge rabbit. They had a picture of him.
Yeah.
So they just can't win. They're having problems. They're having problems everywhere. But I think what's happening, and I think what happened with the American flight over the weekend, is, first of all, the lady gets on the plane. She brings on a stroller that's too big. It doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And they just told her we need to check it. And in taking it out, they bumped her with it. Now, I don't know what was all going on, but she got bumped with it. Appeared to be accidental. Maybe it hurt. I don't know. She begins crying. Another guy confronts. He gets up and he starts threatening the crew, which he should have gotten kicked off. And really, he probably should have been arrested.
Yeah.
And they try to make him out to be a hero because he's confronting the crew. And then they give the lady, I think it was like $1,000, first class passage, all this stuff, because it's just a PR nightmare for them. And everything may not have been done correctly, but I don't think it was that big of a deal. And but they're setting a precedent, and that's what concerns, I think, a lot of people, is that, okay, so you just have to cause a little disruption, pull out your phone and record it, and then say, well, look what they did to me, and play the victim, and now they owe me something. I don't want to fly with people like that. I don't think anybody does.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's opening a door for people to take advantage of airlines. And when you do that, it just makes everyone else, everyone else's travel worse because there's delays and it's just a big scene. And people just want to get where they're going. They don't care about if your arm gets bumped by a little stroller. So I think all that could have been avoided if the lady had checked the regulations and made sure her stroller was the right size for if she wanted to take it on the plane with her. And to check a bag, I mean, it literally takes 30 seconds.
Well, and two, what about the other passengers? I mean, how do you feel if somebody brings on something too big and they take up your space?
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't make you feel good. So anyway, it's just, it's a bad situation for the airlines. And it's a bad situation for, I think the victims at the end of the day are the rest of the people flying, because now you're going to have to deal with more of these individuals that are getting belligerent and getting upset. And you know how it is. I mean, some days you're having a rough day at work. The flight attendants are working. Not an easy job, I can imagine. They do need to be as courteous as they can be, but, you know, how would any of us like it if we were working somewhere and somebody just started bugging us,
yeah,
trying to, like, sort of get a reaction and then want, or just not following the rules? Police officers have to deal with that all the time. People, nah, I don't want to comply. And then there's an incident, and then it's a big thing, and did you handle it right? I don't think any of us would want to deal with that in our day-to-day jobs.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, our whole society is predicated on law, that people obey certain rules so we all can go about our lives and pursue our happiness, as the Declaration of Independence says. That's the whole point. We're supposed to pursue our happiness within the rules, not get in anyone's way, and just all cooperate together. And when people start challenging that, even something simple as just flying on an airplane, it just causes problems and disrupts everything.
Yeah. I mean, we all want people to follow the rules of the road.
Yeah.
Stop at the stop sign, you know, not speed, because it keeps us all safe, keeps things moving. So anyway, interesting, and a lot of people do have to fly quite a bit, and it's getting to be more and more challenging. You've got a really interesting write-up for us here, Abraham, from CBC. Pass the butter. Cutting saturated fat does not reduce heart disease risk, cardiologists say. So that's been the big push over the last 10, 20 years, probably more than that, that, saturated fat, that's the problem, and so you need to replace it with something else. But they're saying now that's not the problem.
Yeah, exactly. This is something that's been reported on before, but I think it's getting more acceptance by the common medical community and by people who deal with health. But I think for a long time, I know growing up, there's always margarine. Can't believe it's not butter. Like the spray-on stuff for your
right.
pan. All those things are alternatives to butter and olive oil and natural fats that we need to cook with, and you put on food and that sort of thing. While it's being found out that saturated fats such as butter, cheese, and meat does not clog your arteries. And so the big idea was that those kind of fats, it gets in your arteries and it causes heart attacks and that sort of thing. But it's actually the exact opposite. And they say that if you eat a healthy balance of meats, cheeses, fish, and have butter, it actually reduces your risk of heart attacks, and it minimizes stress and it brings down your blood pressure. And the big reason why that is that what are the alternatives to butter, cheese, and meat? Those things come from cows and milk and natural means. They come from animals. All the other alternatives are made, are chemicals. They're not real food. They're just complete alternatives. And so those sorts of things have higher carbohydrates, the wrong kind of fats, and then they also have sugar in them. And those are the things that cause overweight, obesity, diabetes, and heart disease.
Right, and that's true in a sense also for milk. When you start getting into some of the fat-free or the, you know, the 1%, I think it is, or different things, or the any of it, really, it's all processed. What they've done is they've taken away the stuff that you need, and so you get all this other stuff that your body doesn't process well. And so you do start to have problems with it. And I don't know all the ins and outs of everything about it. I've looked at it a little bit. But there are a lot of allergies today, right? Lactose intolerance and so forth.
Yeah.
And that could be from a lot of things. I'm not sure. But you do have to wonder, if you're taking in all this processed food and drink, wouldn't your body start reacting to it in a way where it doesn't want it anymore? And we're probably, if you had the natural as it is supposed to exist, maybe you'd be okay with it. I don't know if that's always the case, but it is so interesting because that's the thing people always said. Hey, you've got to drink this non-fat milk because otherwise you're going to get fat, right? But your body doesn't handle it right. And the reality is that stuff will actually give you a greater chance of increasing in weight or any of these negative things that people don't want, because if your body can't process it because they destroyed it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the two most common food allergies right now, it's gluten and probably lactose intolerance. And I think based off of what other people, researchers have said, bread and milk are the most overprocessed foods you can buy. Bread's basically not bread. It's just a mixture of chemicals and pesticides and artificial things, especially white bread.
It's a real wonder.
Yes.
The wonder bread.
Yeah, the wonder bread. You don't know what's inside of it.
We wonder what's in there.
Yeah. And those are the things people are becoming allergic to. I mean, gluten allergies are widespread. And why is it just this generation? And why aren't the baby boomers allergic to bread or gluten like we are, a lot of people are today? It's a lot of it is because of all the unnatural things in our bodies. They destroy our ability to digest certain things.
Yeah, and you know, it's so interesting. There's a great write-up. It's in the Royal Vision magazine. If hopefully most of our listeners have that. If they don't, you can get that. You get a free subscription to that, and you can find it on pcog.org as well. Just about health. There's been one of the recent editions. And it just brings out some facts from this particular book about the food industry. And they're not ignorant of a lot of this. They're not oblivious to what they're doing. But they got to make money. They want to make money. And so they're selling foodless foods. And as is pointed out in that article and the book that it references points out, if you were to eat a lot of the food they're selling you, but you take away the salt, the fat, and the sugar combination to make it palatable, we would probably all just get sick instantly. We certainly wouldn't want to eat it because it's just this chemical compound. It's a foodless food. They know that. They have documentation on the meetings where they've talked about it, but they want to make money. If they don't make money, they go out of business. Money is the driving force, and so we're all being sold things that are not, in fact, foods. But they try to trick our bodies into thinking they are, and then we sit here with allergies, with all these health problems, all these diseases, and then they try to blame it on something like butter or milk coming from cows. That's not the problem.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's unfortunately, just like I think medicine in some ways, selling or trying to get as many prescriptions out just to get more money. Same thing with food. They're trying to get you addicted on the stuff they can sell cheaply or make cheaply and sell to you instead of milk and butter and the healthy food that takes a lot of effort to get to and to preserve and it takes time for even us to prepare it. It's not easy and quick to eat. And so the big thing though that to consider from all this is that if you eat a lot of white bread, pasta, potatoes, a lot of carbohydrates that have sugar in them, I mean, you're setting yourself up to have heart disease, to have obesity, have high blood pressure. Those things can become generational if you don't change that. And I mean, you're setting yourself up for an early grave, and that causes huge problems in families. And I mean, it can just destroy childhood and all that sort of thing. And so this is something that's been going on for decades. And even because I've been watching workout videos for a while, when I started getting into fitness, and they all say, oh, don't eat butter, don't eat fats. You need to eat like the fat-free stuff. And that it's the complete opposite. And so a lot of people bought into that, but now we're having a rise in heart disease because of that change that came about.
It really is just destroying generations of people, that poor diet. So it is very interesting. I mean, it really is, it kind of ties back into that article earlier where we were talking about the screen time.
Yeah.
In some cases, you know, people are on their screens a lot and they find that it's causing anxieties, it's causing these other things. And then sometimes people are going and getting, you know, medication to deal with the anxiety. But the reality is the cause of it is probably something else. Like the medication may somewhat help, but you're not dealing with the cause. Same thing with nutritionally. Medications, like you mentioned, I mean, they sell a lot of them and maybe some people need them. I don't know. But in a lot of cases, it's because the food that's been eaten is poor or it's not even food. And so it's just, but the companies make money all the way down the line with it. And one of the difficulties in trying to get whole food to people is that you can't have a mega corporation.
Yeah.
You can't be, as far as I know, you can't be like the giant corporation that makes all this food because it would have to be more localized.
Yeah.
So that's it's a really fascinating study. A lot of strong thoughts about it from a lot of different sectors, I understand. But interesting to look at and something we all have to think about personally because we have to make our choices. What are we going to eat, not eat, and so forth? It's from the CBC, Pass the Butter.
Yeah. It's something that if some of our listeners are thinking about, they have a workout regimen or other things like that, adding saturated fats can change your life, literally, if you are cutting them out right now.
Yeah. There was a lady that I actually knew a little bit, and she got into running and was running long, long distances, which is, you know, interesting, but lost weight and really got into it and had a trainer, I think a personal trainer, and she was talking about how she needed more energy, she needed that type of thing. Personal trainer said, well, you need to eat a candy bar. Give you some energy, give you some carbs. And that was their advice. And so I don't know how far she went with it, but ended up getting quite a few injuries and I don't even think can run anymore. That's not good advice.
Yeah.
you don't need to load up on a Snickers bar. You probably would be better off with some butter on something.
Yeah, or just eat the stick of butter raw if you're hardcore.
Probably be, yeah. Wouldn't be good for you. That'd be too much. But anyway, really fascinating topic. And there's a lot more about that at the Trumpet at PCOG.org as well. Just some good nutrition guidelines. Okay, one more for you here, Abraham. And this one's you're really interested in, especially. Call of Duty. It's a video game.
Yes.
World War II could be the most important game of all time for historians. So it's Call of Duty World War II.
Yes.
All right. What is this about? What's your take on this?
So this article is from The Guardian, and they're just talking about how in the video game world, historical video games are really popular. First-person shooters where you're a soldier in World War II, World War I, Vietnam, and you go in and you play. And they sell, I think, over billions of dollars every year selling these types of video games. Activision just announced Call of Duty World War II. And then Blizzard Studio, I might be getting the studios mixed up, they launched Battlefield 1, which is their main rival. And so millions of people play these every day. First-person shooters where you're a soldier running around experiencing the action. And the reason historians are interested in these sorts of things is that this is how young people learn history now. It's not from reading books or even watching movies, as from playing these video games where you're in a campaign of taking Berlin, D-Day, whatever it might be. And so the video game tells you the story and what's going on, and then you act out your part in it in the video game. And so these historians want to sit down and make sure these games are accurate. The problem is that's not the way people should be intaking history. And that's not only are video games violent and it's not realistic. They can get realistic, but it's still not war. Sitting comfy in your chair shooting people on the screen is not warfare. Doesn't matter how realistic it gets. But then this is how young people learn things. I know I had friends growing up and they played Metal Gear Solid, which is based during the Cold War, different games. And they're like, oh, yeah, I remember hearing about that in that video game once, something about Khrushchev and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that's all they know. They don't know anything else. And so historians want to start using video games to teach history, or at least capitalize on it. But I think it's wrong to surrender to video games. And we need to retake history in the classrooms and actually teach them what's actually going on.
Well,
There's a couple of issues there, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, what's the result of people spending their time playing first shooter video games? I think the evidence is pretty solid that it's not a good idea to do that. But also the history side of it. That's a really interesting point. I never thought about it. I'm not involved in these games. I've seen a commercial or two for them, I guess. But that's an interesting thought as well, that they're actually learning some historical things, but not in a way that is really teaching them. And I don't know if it's accurate or not, and whether it is or not, it's kind of irrelevant. I can't help but think about people that actually went through some of those things. I bet they wouldn't want anything to do with it, you know, that actually went through World War II. I don't think they want to sit down and, like, rehash it. Some of the best, when we were in high school, some of the best things that I remember from history classes was when we actually had people come in and talk to us about their experiences. And one day we had a survivor from the concentration camps come and address the school. And that was, like, one of my most memorable things from high school as far as history is concerned. So I would much prefer something like that as opposed to these fantasies.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I know from being in that generation, having lots of friends who play these types of games, they don't care about the history portion of it. That's lost in the what they like is being able to kill someone on a screen. That's what they enjoy. So, I mean, there are some exceptions to that rule. But what it does is when you play these games, you don't realize that in war, you're a band of brothers. And when someone dies, it's like losing your family member. And there is none of that emotion. There's none of that crisis in a video game. And so they're missing the whole point of, or a vital part of understanding war and history. But also, these video games, most of the times they take a name from history, they take a concept, but they change it completely. And so there's usually a completely false narrative, if we can use that, of what actually happened, and people think it's real. There's a game called Assassin's Creed where you're an assassin running around killing people, and it's based in different times in history. The Renaissance in Italy, the Americans, War of Revolution, and that sort of thing. So there's like names and events and that kind of thing, but you're not learning anything from that about George Washington or the point of the Constitution, why the war was fought. All you know is that there's some violence going on and you want to be a part of that violence. It's not teaching you the nobler aspects of history. And so it's just a huge detriment to our society. And if we want to use video games to teach history, it's only going to make our historical ignorance worse, and then just on top of all the other problems with first-person shooters and violent video games.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It makes me think of the just that idea that, you know, if we don't teach our kids, somebody will.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to learn something, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. And this is an example of that, to where if a teacher or a parent or whatever isn't going to actively teach their kids and they allow them into this, yeah, they're going to learn something. But it's going to be the wrong stuff as far as even just the historical context. But then it desensitizes them to war too. I mean, war is a terrible, terrible thing. Well, there shouldn't be war, but sadly there is. And it makes it almost, I don't know what the best way to say it is. It just desensitizes their minds to it. Put some false historical thoughts in there. What about why did we fight in wars? Like, what were we fighting for?
Yeah.
Like, how about those things? The whole thing just doesn't sit right with me.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's this other game I saw. It's you're a sniper, and it slows down and shows you exactly what you do to someone when you kill them with a bullet. So very, very graphic. But what it does is you get rewarded for killing people, even if they're... And, I mean, in war, you do kill the enemy. That's how you win. But what it does, it creates a game mode of murder.
Yeah.
And, I mean, killing someone is not an easy thing to do. It's a huge moral quandary. Even if they're your enemy, you're ending another person's life. And video games remove that moral question in everyone's mind from it, because it's part of the game. You win. You get rewarded for the act of murder by killing someone on a screen. And so by removing that moral quandary or that first resistance we have to that sort of thing, it just destroys our young people.
Yeah, it takes something very real, and it moves into the world of fantasy.
Yeah, exactly.
And you do that enough, and pretty soon, you just live in a world of fantasy, don't you?
You can't tell the difference between the two.
Unbelievable. Interesting. Call of Duty World War II could be the most important game of all time for historians. It's a strange, strange time.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us here on this Wednesday. Hope you have a great rest of your day. And make sure you listen for the Key of David, Trumpet Daily, and the Trumpet Hour program. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.